Thanks. Still Steve, still an alcoholic. Week two. Last week, I basically tried to kind of introduce myself to the group and qualify and describe my journey getting to Big Book recovery in these 12 steps, because I did not hit the ground running into recovery. I got sober back in the mid-90s originally, but my current sobriety date is April 18th of 2014. My home group is the Comma Solution Group. We meet on Monday nights in Princeton, New Jersey, 33 Mercer Street at 7:30. Currently, we have a hybrid meeting, so we have online and in-person as well. And we basically have speakers come in from within an hour drive and share their experience line by line with the text, and just try to help people like the new guys that are in here tonight maybe have a deeper experience or have their first experience with this thing called recovery that it took me 18 years to get in touch with. As I said last week, I kind of did the things you do out of rehab. You go to 90 meetings in 90 days and get a coffee commitment and get a sponsor and kind of Big Book recovery wasn't a real big thing back in the mid-90s. It was you go to different speaker meetings and things like that, and they'll take you to the pages where they tell you you've worked the first three steps getting here and follow the directions for your life story inventory, and you just sit down and tell somebody with it and tell somebody your story. And not much happened. I was able to get some time together, and after white knuckling it for a period of time and getting back into college and graduating and finding things getting a little bit better throughout the years, I made it 12 years, and suddenly the thought crossed my mind to pick up a drink, and it took me 6 years to put that drink back down. And I had no idea what I suffered from, and when I'd gone to this Jersey Shore Roundup thing that I was referring to last week, it was the first time I'd ever heard anybody talking about the Big Book, the steps, what I actually suffered from, and they broke it down for me in ways that I had never heard before, and I thought I had done AA. I had done the things they tell you when you get out of rehab, just don't drink and go to meetings, 90 meetings in 90 days, and then I'm hearing people say, well, that's not part of our program. Great suggestions, need you to do that, be awesome if you can. But what you got to understand is you're suffering from a disease that's far greater than you can handle that 90 meetings won't treat. And I was like, come again? And I had no idea what they were talking about. So I start down this path, and I started last week talking about the doctor's opinion. And this guy, Dr. Silkworth, the world's prominent doctor on alcoholism, had observed over 50,000 of us and came up that we have some type of an allergy, right? This allergy, like people who suffer from strawberries and things like that, they break out and have a reaction. For us, it's for more alcohol, he's contributed some letters to our book and, basically signing off his reputation that, you guys can rely wholeheartedly on what these guys are talking about, because that's been my experience. And when we go and find out if you have this, it's, the doctor's opinion says, we believe and so suggested a few years ago that the action of alcohol in these chronic alcoholics is a manifestation of an allergy, that the phenomenon of craving is limited to this class and never occurs in the average temperate drinker. So I had to ask myself, has this ever occurred to me? Have I ever gone out and said, I'm only going to drink this much? Right? And I could tell you hundreds of times I did that. And somehow, some way during the course of the night, I changed my mind. Six was a stupid number, or whatever it was. And I had the couple of thoughts going, well, sometimes I could and sometimes I couldn't. And it was one of those things that I used to hold on to, that maybe I'm not one of you guys. And if I'm not one of you guys, I don't have to do all the things that you guys are doing to get well. Because I was looking for where I was different, not where I identified. And alcoholics don't like to be cornered. They want to keep an out. right? So that was like my little out. And, you know, having a good sponsor and people who have had experience with this stuff and have been in my shoes go, yeah, but were you the one in control of when that happened and when it couldn't? And I was like, well, no. Then you're powerless. And if you have this craving, this phenomenon of craving, this allergy, then ollie ollie oxen free, you're one of us, because it never occurs in the average temperate drinker. So if you qualify for the physical craving, you've got the mental obsession. Because if you knew you had a craving, then the solution would be just don't drink and go to meetings, because you'd have the power to do that. But my problem is I got a mind, no matter how long I'm sober, the same voice that tells me to put the drink down is the one that tells me to pick the drink back up. And no thought enters my head that maybe I'm not being too clever here. Maybe this isn't going to go as well as it did all the other times that I picked up a drink and said, it's not going to hurt me this time. And, you know, sometimes I'd get away with one. And then before I know it, a week or so later, now I'm back behind the eight ball again, drinking every day, going, how did I ever get started again? And it always starts with this little thought, right? Maybe I can handle it this time. Despite all the evidence to the contrary. Now, that right there is, and I used the analogy last week of thinking of alcoholism as, just think of a class of second graders. And we've got all different types of second graders. Tall ones, short ones, fat ones, skinny ones, black ones, white ones. The one thing they all have in common is they're all in the second grade. Right? So that common problem that we have, this phenomenon of craving, even though we might not have hung out together, we might not have drank together, or we don't even drink the same way, the fact that I can't control it once I start, and I can't stay stopped once I stop, that's our common problem. Because if that's not our common problem, and we suffer from meeting deficiency, then meetings would treat alcoholism, right? So back to the point of, if that's our common problem, now we all have a common solution, which is the 12 steps in this relationship with this higher power. Because if the common problem is anything but that, the solution's debatable. And it's able to be watered down and say, well, this is what I do. I'm not going to bet a newcomer's life on my opinion on what I think is going to work for them or what may have worked for me if it differs from this book. And I had gotten that when I was absolutely dying in Alcoholics Anonymous, where I'd go to people for help and they'd say, you know, they'd throw a slogan at me, or they'd say, up your meetings, and I'm dying on the inside. And I wasn't going to the types of meetings that talked about, hey, why don't you come over here and sit down with me and let me read a few things to you and try to qualify you with this stuff. Qualify? What the hell are you talking about? Because it's pretty simple. I mean, we agnostics kind of explains it to us in their paragraph. But, I mean, I'll get to that. But what's nice about this book is it's an old school textbook that basically, like I said last week, it tells you what it's going to tell you. Then it tells you. Then it tells you what it told you. And it's designed for you to basically have an experience. It is a blueprint for a spiritual experience or spiritual awakening, which is the only solution this book carries. That's like, what do the words only mean to you? You know? And it's like, I don't like that answer. I got a problem I can't solve and a solution I don't like. You know, our book calls that a dilemma. So as we go through this doctor's opinion thing and I realize I've got this phenomenon of craving, all of a sudden my heart starts beating, right? And I'm like, wait a minute, this is something bigger than I thought it was, right? I have a problem much bigger than I thought I did. You know, because I got out of rehab and they were saying, just don't drink and go to meetings. As if I could. That would imply I had power, right? So I get into this process, and I was given at this point, and this is what I do with new guys that aren't like on death's door. I'll give them an exercise because I want to see them. Not that I'm happy that I'm satisfied that they qualify as alcoholic, but I need them to see if they are. So I'm going to give them the tools like they were given to me to qualify based on my own experience. So anywhere the book makes a statement, I was taught to turn it into a question and personalize it. And that way, all of a sudden, this book written back in 34 or 5, published in 39, gets on me a little bit. And all of a sudden, it applies to me today, which is kind of cool because today being the anniversary of Bill's last drink, 87 years ago. I mean, it's kind of surreal sitting here, looking what these guys went through for us, so that we could have a program to recover from this terminal illness, right? 12. There's the whole miracle of 12. 12, 12. Builds sobriety date. 12 steps. 12 traditions. Thought that was kind of cool when I heard that. I was like, that sounds like Bill. So I was given this exercise for Bill's story to break up the first 8 pages to highlight any sentence where I thought, drank, or felt like Bill did. So I would go through this because I didn't relate much to a stockbroker or, back the language that they spoke. But I did relate to how he thought about alcohol, how he drank it, and how he felt. And those were the things I found useful, because all of a sudden I'm seeing the progression of Bill's alcoholism in the first 8 pages. And then the second 8 pages, I was taught to basically highlight or underline anything that I wasn't willing to do that Bill did to get sober. Right? And when you start going through this process, and like it was done for me, I was put in these pages so that I could basically catch alcoholism. I was there working with somebody, so what I didn't know was their job was to give me a fatal dose of alcoholism. So by the time I get to step 2, like I got the cold sweats and I'm just like, oh my God, I've got a terminal illness. Right? It's far more than just coming here eating cookies and drinking coffee, right? And just sharing. It's basically my life is on the line with being able to have this experience and carry this message, because there's people here that are new, that are coming back after a relapse, that may not know what they suffer from or what this process is or what they're up against. So I'm going to try to kind of explain it in a way that was how I would take a new person through it and what my experience was with this. I might be a little bit all over the place for that reason, but as I went through Bill's story, you'll have your own experience with what you underline and things like that, but the things that really got caught in my throat was page 8, paragraph 1, that no words can tell the loneliness and despair I found in that bitter morass of self-pity. Quicksand stretched around me in all directions. I had met my match. I had been overwhelmed. Alcohol was my master. Complete ego deflation. Hopelessness. And I don't know about you, but I can't tell you how many times I've had that feeling where I was, had I maybe during that time when I was at that hopeless, helpless place, if somebody had approached me with this message this way, or if I was going to meetings or even knew to ask, for help, then maybe I'd be able to have latched on to this sooner. But, whatever. Now, if we go to page 14, this is another thing I like to point out to new guys and what really stuck in my throat. Because this right here is one of the big things why I went back out. 14, down at the bottom, it says, where is it? 14, paragraph 6, where it says, if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink. And again, if he drank, he would surely die. That's a triple conditional warning. that's like triple dog dare you kind of stuff. Right, I have to perfect and enlarge my spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice. So they're all of a sudden they're starting to bait us a little bit with this self thing. Like they're starting to move us away. Yes, alcohol and drugs is a tremendous problem, but they're starting to point out the fact. And in the literary world, this is called foreshadowing, right? And they start like setting the table for this self piece. And man, I know what I look back at when the 12 years I was dry, and I was not working to perfect and enlarge my spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others. I was trying to just don't drink and go to meetings so I can get out and get cash and prizes. That's what I was trying to do, right? Because I thought once you get the problem of drugs and alcohol off me, now you've removed the problem. Now I can go out and manage my life and check those life boxes, which I never could do. So I get through that, and it kind of takes us into there is a solution, and it tells us at the beginning of the chapter that we're basically seeing this to see if we were just as hopeless as Bill was. Because if we're just as hopeless as Bill was, we're screwed. Like, we have, like, what? There are no other options in this book. You know, just don't drink, go to meetings, and get the right job. Just don't drink, go to meetings, and, you know, have the right amount of money in the bank account kind of stuff. It doesn't work that way. I wish to God it did, because I tried many of those door number threes in my 12-year stint in sobriety. It didn't work. I'm just glad Amazon wasn't around back then. So it says, we of Alcoholics Anonymous know thousands of men and women who were once just as hopeless as Bill. That's why we go through Bill's story, and they put it right there, because it was the most relatable story at the front of the book. It wasn't just Bill's ego going, you know, let's put mine up here. Nearly all have recovered. They have solved the drink problem. You know, and that was a big piece, because in rehab, I would hear recovering. I'll always be recovering. And maybe from my character defects and my thinking. But this whole thing in the beginning of the book talks about recovering from a hopeless state of mind and body, which means I no longer suffer from the mental obsession that triggers the allergy to pick up the drink. And then I get on this alcoholic cycle where I drink until I got to stop, and then I stop until I got to drink, and then I get so restless, irritable, and discontented because of this third part, this spiritual malady, that's what tells my mind to pick the drink back up. And then on and on I go. And that is terminal. That's what we die from, right? You know, we die from all different types of things. I'm passing out, falling down a flight of stairs, aspirating, vomit, dying, you know, walking out into traffic. That's dying of alcoholism. You know, the things that scared me the most was living for the next 40 years feeling the way I was feeling but not dying. Because I used to drive drunk all the time. And that stuff didn't scare me. Because I'd be like, then the voices would stop. Then it would be over kind of a stuff. And I was wishing for the end at the end of this. I mean, it's crazy what this stuff does. So it says, we are people who normally would not mix, but there exists among us a fellowship, a friendliness, and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. We are like the passengers of a great liner in the moment after rescue from shipwreck, when camaraderie, joyousness, and democracy pervade the vessel from steerage to captain's table. Now, it's a cool little thing, because this is back in the days of Titanic, right? And you got all these people down in the bowels of the ship, which are the blue-collar guys, the lower-class guys, and then you got the guys up here at the captain's table who are wealthy and this, that, and the other thing. Problem is they're all on the Titanic, right? Doesn't matter where they're from or what they're doing. When that ship goes down, I don't care what your financial portfolio looks like, right? And that's not what keeps us together. The fact that we're all in the water is a problem, and we need to get out of the water as quickly as possible. So it says, unlike the feelings of the ship passengers, however, our joy in escape from disaster does not subside as we go in our individual ways. The feeling of having shared in a common peril, I got this phenomenon of craving and this mental obsession, right? Is one element in the powerful cement that binds us, which... But that in itself would never have held us together as we are now joined. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution, the 12 steps, this relationship with a higher power, right? That's going to take me out of me. Because we're going to start like leaving alcohol and drugs in the rear view and appear. Once that mental obsession's gone, they're going to kind of keep setting us up here as Bill. This is the ultimate 12-step right here. This is Bill in the first 100, 12-stepping us. Because back in the day, this was mail-order sobriety, right? So this is basically a written 12-step for the reader to be like, do you have this? Has this happened to you? Great, because we're going to spend 43 pages plus the doctor's opinion talking about the first half of the first step. So it's pretty important that you qualify yourself whether or not you have this. Because if you don't think you have this, you aren't going to do what 2 through 12 ask you to do. Right? That was my experience. And that's been the experience of every guy that I've worked with that I've talked to about willing to go to any lengths. I have to explain to them what that looks like. And I'll take them over to page 59 where the 12 steps are outlined. And I will go through each one and explain how the first half of the first step is before the dash. And the dash is a literary thing that basically implies that everything that comes before the dash applies to what's after it. And the unmanageability isn't just the crazy stuff that happens to us when we're drunk. That's like drunkenness stuff, right? DUIs and things like that. Those are results of my drinking. Right? This unmanageability, this is a spiritual, restless, irritable, and discontentedness, right? And this book is brilliantly outlined because It doesn't tell us what that spiritual malady is, really. Because if you differ from it, even a little bit, there's your out the door. So it doesn't tell you what the spiritual experience is. It doesn't tell you what God is. But it tells you exactly what's wrong with you and tells you exactly what to do to get out of that water. Right? So that's the thing that it tells us to do. Specifically, precisely. I've heard people say, well, the program's different for everybody. Works their own program. And Dr. Bob was like, no, the program's the same for everybody. It's clear cut. Right? Everybody has their own experience with it. And that's the difference. Because we can find a way our ego can find a way to bend words to meet our will and say, see? Until you say it out loud. Right? All right, so it says the tremendous fact for everyone is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out on which we can absolutely agree and upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. This is the great news this book carries to those who suffer from alcoholism. Right? So that whole step one piece is pretty simple. It's like, can you stop once you start, and can you stay stopped once you decide to stop? And if the answer is no, great, you just qualified for a terminal illness. Welcome. it says 18, paragraph 1, an illness of this sort, and we have become to believe it, an illness involves those about us in a way no other human sickness can. If a person has cancer, all are sorry for him and no one is angry or hurt, but not so with the alcoholic illness, for with it, there goes annihilations of all things worthwhile in life. Boom. Pause for dramatic effect. Wow. What if that's true? It engulfs all whose lives touch the sufferers. It brings misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends and employers, warped lives of blameless children, sad wives and parents. Anyone can increase the list. Has this been your experience? What was it like when you were drinking? Ain't you glad the wind? Ain't you glad? I'm so glad the wind stopped blowing. Right? When I'm the wind. Right? I'm the storm that's coming out saying, wow, isn't it great it's over? And people are looking at me like I'm insane going, how long is this going to last? Right? And they'll pretend that the elephant in the room's a coffee table. That's denial. I'm in delusion because I just believe the story I just said. And that's the difference, I think, between the Al-Anon and the alcoholic in a relationship. I happen to be married to a non-alcoholic. All right, so, but the ex-problem drinker, this is down here in italics, right? This is something I have on page 89, but when I start working with others, I have to go back and touch this and remember this when I'm talking to a new guy, right? Italics, this is Bill yelling at you, the squiggly lines. But the ex-problem drinker who has found this solution, who is properly armed with the facts about himself, remember, phenomenon of craving, mental obsession, spiritual malady, these are the facts about myself that I need to talk about my drinking with a new guy, not his, right? So it says, can generally win the entire confidence of another alcoholic in a few hours. Until such an understanding is reached, little or nothing can be accomplished. That's pretty heavy. So when I go in, if I'm talking to a wet drunk or somebody who's skeptical, or we don't have a lot of wet drunk work anymore, because of detoxes and things like that. And a lot of these guys I'll meet in detox, so I get to go through this stuff a little bit more like they did in the old days. And I'll try to find out as much as I can about somebody and share my experience with drinking, because we're so self-centered, we're always going to think what anybody else is talking about, how that applies to me. Am I okay? Is that all right? Things like that. There's a solution goes on to kind of talk about the different types of drinkers on page 20, right? We got the social drinker, right? The moderate drinker, the hard drinker, he may have the habit badly enough to gradually impair himself physically and mentally. It may cause him to die a few years before his time. If a sufficiently strong reason, ill health, falling in love, change of environment, warning of a doctor becomes operative, he's able to stop or moderate. And, man, I failed all of those miserably. And the only thing that was left was the real alcoholic. And I hated this answer, because if I'm the real alcoholic, I got to do all this stuff, right? You know, I love what the book says later on. It's like, though the program's very sensible, it's kind of drastic. It's like, I got to start, like, I'm thinking I have to start, you know, with the finger chimes and shave my head and hand out flowers at the airport kind of a stuff. You know, and I grew up Catholic, and I was like, man, I'm not going back there. I am not going back there, because that was really hard on me. I had all these old ideas and things that, you know, I had an opinion about an experience I hadn't had here. And I'm going to sit here and go through this stuff. Well, I'm not doing this, and I'm not doing that. And, you know, and I'm missing the point if I'm thinking that, because that implies I have power. Okay, that means I didn't understand step one. It always is going to come back to there. Anything I don't feel like doing later always comes back to thinking somehow, some way, I've got power and self-reliance is going to fix it. Self-knowledge, you know, I went through that whole phase early on. Like, if I just had enough knowledge about this book and this disease and sound good at meetings, that would treat my alcoholism. No, I got sicker behind that. And the fact that I could say some of the right things made it so people wouldn't approach me. And that was miserable. There is nothing worse than sitting in an AA meeting feeling like you're drowning in self. And you're not even drinking. Okay, over to the top of page 23, they start to transition from, Steve, you just took a drink, what happens to you, to what happens, the mental states preceding the first drink, right? So it says, The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this, which is we are equally positive that once Steve takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens both in the bodily and mental sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. And me even knowing this doesn't help me, because I got a mind 5 minutes from now that's going to forget that, and I'm going to have a thought where, you know, maybe I could do it again this time. That's the insanity that we're talking about here around the first drink, because they're about to go from 23 to 43 and talking about exactly that. Forget about the alcohol in your system. Now let's take a look at what happens in your mind before you pick that drink back up after you finally stopped. And they go through all these different stories which are pretty crazy, which when I first read them, I was just like, "This, I've never done any of that stuff." And then after my relapse in 6 years, three of the four stories applied to me. And I was like, oh my God, you know, talk about a horror show. So as we're sitting here on, there's a solution here. They transition from the mind to the body. And I go down to paragraph four here, where it says, the tragic truth is that if the man be a real alcoholic, the happy day may not arrive. He has lost control. At a certain point in the drinking of every alcoholic, he passes into a state where the most powerful desire to stop drinking is of absolutely no avail. The tragic situation has arrived in practically every case long before it is suspected. So me having a desire to stop only gives me a seat in an AA meeting. It does not help me get sober. Right? And then they tell us this thing down here with in italics again. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice in drink. What an interesting choice of words that is. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We are unable at certain times, right? That's the beautiful part of at certain times, because I had that. At certain times I could. And then my sponsor blew it out of the water with, are you the one in control of when that happens? And I was like, no. At certain times, to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of a week or even a month ago. We are without defense against the first drink. Now, what's crazy about that is this power of choice in drink, not with drinking, with, you know, whatever you could use that would make it sound like less old English. My grand sponsor's home group has a big 1936 dictionary, and one night he goes, look up the word in. And they read this, in, with respect to, indicating inclusion, encompassment, or engrossment as to scope, influence, character, state, condition, attribute, degree, or activity. That means I have lost the power of choice when it comes to alcohol when I'm drinking, when I stop drinking, and before... And while I'm drinking, you know, all these things, like anything having to do with alcohol, I have no choice over. I remember Chris S. and Dave P. came down to our home group. And Chris was reading that, and he goes, "Dave, how much power is powerless?" And with a straight face, Dave looks over and goes, "Not a whole hell of a lot, Chris." And I was like, man, this is one of the, that's the insanity that I suffer from, that somehow, some way, I think I can get away with it this time, or somehow, some way, it's going to be different. You know, it's my inability to see the truth about my relationship to alcohol. You know, in all step two, being restored to sanity, when that happens in step 10, it's like I can finally see the truth in that. Right? I finally can relate myself right to that right perspective. That on my own power, without these steps and disciplines in my life, on my own, my experience has shown me that I will put alcohol back in my body. That's losing the power of choice. Okay? And with that comes either go on to the bitter end or accept spiritual help. Right? Not a lot of options there. So we get to Roland Hazard. Now this is just really cool. He goes into this weird story. And Roland, this is one of those founding moments, and I'm feeling kind of nostalgic about the start of AA and, you know, Bill's anniversary, last drink of today. And, you know, Roland was this really wealthy guy that, you know, had all this money, and he couldn't stop drinking. He was like a shut-in. He was like an embarrassment to his family. And he ended up going over to see one of the greatest psychiatrists in Carl Jung, right? And there was Adler, there was Freud, and Jung. Back in the day. And Jung was the only one who believed in spirituality, that there was a spirit side. And Adler and Freud were all about intellect and, you know, tell me about your mother kind of stuff. And they didn't believe in this spiritual element. And they weren't available anyway because, you know, Roland could afford to see him. So he basically goes to see him. And he spends a year with him. And he finds out all about this self-knowledge about himself and all these, you know, inner workings of how his mind works. And he spends a year, and he gets back on the train or whatever to get to the boat back to the States, and he didn't even make it to the boat, and he drank. And he comes back, he's passed out in like France somewhere, they found him. And he comes back and he's begging Carl Jung to tell him what his deal was. He's like, "Am I doomed or what?" And he's just like, "Man," he goes, "you know, here and there, once in a while, alcoholics have had what are called vital spiritual experiences. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements, ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men, are suddenly cast to one side, and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate." He's like, "Man, I've been trying to produce that in you, but I've failed." He was one of these guys that wasn't one of us, that cared about us deeply and gave us a huge piece of our illness. Now, we got on the other side of the ocean, we've got Dr. Silkworth, who has basically given us this phenomenon of craving piece, right? And this whole mental obsession, spiritual malady thing came from him. And they saw the same thing on the other side. And then without these two people, we wouldn't have known what we really suffered from. Now, Dr. Bob in Ohio is suffering, knows there's a spiritual experience that he needs to have, but he doesn't know what he suffers from. And when Roland came back and was a part of the Oxford group, and he carried the message to Ebby, who carried the message to Bill. And with that, those founding moments, like, this is why this started that ball rolling down this path of how we got to Alcoholics Anonymous, why we have a place to come to tonight, so that we're not, you know, somewhere out drinking or in a hospital or dead, right? And it just kind of blows my mind. I was looking at the, you know, the calendar this morning. I'm going, "Oh man, it's Bill's anniversary of his last drink today." It's pretty wild. Reminds me of a. I got time to tell this. So my grand sponsor runs this golf tournament down, an AA golf tournament, and it was, you know, how we get, they get, it's down in Austin, Texas, and he, I love this story because he told it at the podium once, and I share it every time I remember this, and it was one of the things that just kind of grasped me about the gravity of the situation that I was in. And he told this story that he was sitting there on a hole waiting for these guys to get out of the way. There's a bunch of guys on a hole backed up, and the starter comes up and he sits down and down next to Charlie, and he goes, "So you guys are AA, huh?" And he's like, "Yeah, that's what we're AA, all right." And he goes, "You know, my dad was an alcoholic." And Charlie's like, "Oh, okay, really?" He goes, "Yeah, he was a real nasty one, too. Never got sober and found you guys, but he did end up quitting drinking. He was horribly racist. He was angry all the time. He beat his kids and his wife. Just a miserable guy, especially when he drank." And he goes, "One day, he falls into a coma, right? And everybody's preparing for the end and, you know, thinking he drank himself to death. And they're all in the hospital room at the hospital bed. And he's mumbling under his breath. And he's just like talking about like, okay, I got to leave you now, but a new person is going to come and take my place. And all of a sudden his arms go up like this and they fall to the bed. And everybody thought he died. And what's crazy is, you know, a few minutes later he wakes up a completely changed dude. He never changes. He never drinks again. Doesn't cuss anymore. Keeps a bottle of liquor underneath the sink in case guests that come over to his house drink. And he's no longer racist, he's no longer angry, he's no longer beating his wife and kids, and something happened to him. So Dr. Young is basically saying, "Roland, brother, you need one of those." And I'm like, whoa, that's heavy. But that's the crazy thing. Could you imagine if we didn't have a book with directions to have exactly that experience? We'd be screwed. But we do. That's exactly what this book is about. It's to have one of those experiences. But you have to do it. You can't know it. You don't learn it. These are directions in here that we do. And hopefully you're beat up enough where you go back to your sponsor or step guide and say, "Okay, that's done. Now what do you need me to do?" Because I get these guys that kind of come into inventory and they kind of balk at inventory and amends. That's where the ego rebuilds, and they go, "Well, I don't feel like I have to do that because my life's gotten better." And they drink or they use or they do whatever it is that they do, right? And they come back and they drink until they got to stop. They stop until they got to drink. They do that whole that song and dance, right? And we die from it. And I'm tired of watching guys that I work with die and keep relapsing. And it's just like, man, it's like, what did I miss? What did I not explain? You know? And, you know, it's not up to me. I'm not that powerful. All right. So, on to more about alcoholism. Now, this is basically where they talk about that mental obsession. And they go through all these guys' stories. Like, has this happened to you? Can you relate to any of this? Now, I'm not going to go through all the stories, but I will read this first paragraph. We read this at the beginning of every meeting instead of How It Works, because most people kind of tune out when How It Works and they come back into the room at the ABCs and they're just like, okay, here we go. So it says, "Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. No person likes to admit he is bodily, which means the allergy, and mentally, which means we've got the obsession. He is different from his fellows. Therefore, it is not surprising that our drinking careers have been characterized by countless vain attempts to prove we could drink like other people. The idea that somehow, someday, he will control and enjoy his drinking is the great obsession of every abnormal drinker. The persistence of this illusion is astonishing. Many pursue it into the gates of insanity or death. We had to learn to fully concede to our innermost selves that we were alcoholics." Now, that was a really interesting saying, because I wrote this in my sidelight here. It said, "More than one self." And I had no idea how prophetic that would be, which this whole talk is basically about this innermost self. That means there's other layers to self, which were, again, here's that self piece coming back again. I missed this for so long. This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that we are like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. Not just maybe, you might want to reconsider that. Smashed. Right? Like, dude, if you hold on to any of that, chances are you're going to put alcohol back in your body, or you're going to live a life where you wish you did, right? We alcoholics are men and women who have lost the ability to control our drinking, because if I got to control it, I can't enjoy it, and when I enjoy it, I can't control it. We know that no real alcoholic ever recovers control. All of us felt that sometimes that we were regaining control, But such intervals, usually brief, were inevitably followed by still less control, which led to, in time, to pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. We are convinced to a man that alcoholics of our type are in the grip of a progressive illness. Over any considerable period, we get worse, never better. That spells doom, right? And that's a bad doctor's visit right there. So I won't go into all the stories, but you know, the jaywalker I related to, the man of 30, you know, after 12 years thinking that surely I can enjoy a glass of lager after 12 years. Jim, whiskey and milk is kind of disgusting, but suddenly the thought crossed my mind, actually happened to me. That's when I picked up that drink after 12 years. And with Fred, like not a cloud on the horizon. Like things, when I picked up that drink, things were at their absolute best. I'm traveling around the world, teaching golf. I've got money in the bank. I'm, you know, hanging with celebrities and stuff. And alcohol blew it all up, right? Because I thought this self-knowledge piece, this my self-knowledge would save me from this that strange mental blank spot, right? I never had a pause and think the drink through. And suddenly comes suddenly. The insanity comes quick and returns slow. But it's usually after I picked up that drink and I'm like, what the hell did I do? Right? That's this insanity that we suffer from. That we don't know we suffer from it because it's in our own voice. And if it's in my own voice, it must be right. It must be my thoughts. No. When the hell did my thinking mind... When did I become a slave to my mind? My mind is supposed to be a tool for my spirit. And somehow, some way, mine got reversed. And the only way I could treat the pain of that is by pouring booze and drugs on it for years and years and years, right? So we get through all this stuff and more about alcoholism. And I love these little things here on page 40 where it says... I rather appreciated your ideas about the subtle insanity, meaning the ideas, meaning we have got an allergy and an obsession, and the subtle insanity, which is our obsession, which precedes the first drink. But I was confident it could not happen to me after what I had learned, after how many meetings I've got to, after all this stuff about my triggers and my therapy and my inner child and stuff, which is great to look into. But again, it might add fuel to the fire of your alcoholism, but it's not what causes it. Otherwise, there's a lot of people in here with trauma and without it that are still alcoholic, right? That's not what has our common problem. We have a lot of similar experiences like that, but it's not what makes us alcoholic. Otherwise, we'd have a trauma section in here, okay? But I was confident it could not happen to me after what I had learned. I reasoned I was not so far as advanced as you fellas, but that I had been usually successful in licking my other personal problems and that I would therefore be successful where you men failed. I felt I had every right to be self-confident, that it would only be a matter of expressing my willpower and keeping on guard. For what? Suddenly? Suddenly he's going to drop on me like a piano, right? And I'm not going to see it coming. Over on to 42 here. This is, but the program of action, though entirely sensible, was pretty drastic. It meant I would have to throw several lifelong conceptions out the window, like I could manage my own life. Like that that God was this power that I had to get in touch with. Like I thought I neatly postponed or and evaded that. So, you know, we basically get through this process, and if I'm working with somebody, I'm asking them questions about their life. Has this happened to you? Tell me examples. Now, all of a sudden, you kind of start feeling like Bruce Willis in The Sixth Sense when he finds out he's the dead guy. Like you go, oh my God, and you know, you get that whole terminal case of alcoholism on you. So you get to step two with a gun to your head. You know, you got a terminal illness that you can't keep yourself sober from. And... you know, I love what the... remember how I told you how the book will tell you what it's going to tell you, then it tells you what it told you, and then gives you all these little summaries. It says, in the preceding chapters, you've learned something of alcoholism, phenomenon of craving, mentalist. By this time, you're so sick of hearing about this stuff, right? It's like, okay, I get it. Right? I'm on board. It's happened to me. We hope you have made clear the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic, phenomenon of craving, mental obsession, spiritual malady. If when you honestly want to, you find you cannot quit entirely, or... if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you are probably an alcoholic. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. bad news, right? You know, if you had my experience, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. If a mere code of morals or a better philosophy of living were sufficient to overcome alcoholism, many of us would have recovered long ago. Our human resources, as needed, as marshaled by the will, were not sufficient. They failed utterly. Our needed power wasn't there, right? So it basically says lack of power. That was our dilemma. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. But where and how are we to find this power? Now they're starting to set up this need for inventory, because it's going to answer this question on page 55, right? It says, well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, capital P, which will solve your problem, right? So as we go through these little considerations for we agnostics, the bottom here, let's see here, we found that God does not make too hard of terms for those who seek him, right? And 40, so it's, we found, you know, as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice, express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results. So they're starting to tell us there are some necessities to commence spiritual growth. They're also going to tell us what blocks it, right? God does not provide too hard of terms for those who seek him. To us, the realm of the spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never excluding or forbidding. To those who earnestly seek, which means I got to go out of my way and take action to develop a relationship with this power because my life depends on it. That my happiness depends on it. The happiness of those I care about depend on it, right? So it says, do I now believe or am I even willing to believe that there's a power greater than myself? Right? First half of step two, right? So as we get to that, we go over to we who have traveled this dubious path beg you to lay aside prejudice even against organized religion. That was me. This one hit me like a ton of bricks because I had, like, there was no way I was going to go down this path. And basically, this told me, says, Steve, where's your choice? Where do you think you have a choice in the matter, knowing that you just qualified for this illness? And I was like, but what's nice is it tells us that I can lay the gun on the table and be set my compass in this direction and be willing to take some action and have an experience. And the consciousness of my belief is sure to come to me. And that had been my experience with this. Once I said, okay, forget everything I learned, now I'm going to go and take these steps, not out of choice, not out of me wanting to be a good spiritual guy. It's because, you know, my ass was on fire, basically, you know. And that's where I do most of my growing, with my arm twisted up behind my back. My sponsor reads this to me every time I get in self-reliance, and he just goes, let's go to page 50. We never gave the spiritual side of life a fair hearing. And, you know, I get so wrapped around the axle thinking about what I need to get from work, what I need to have happen in the world. The person in the Lincoln Tunnel isn't driving fast enough. You know, I think I know what I need to be happy. And it's always out there. It's never in here with a relationship of something bigger than me, because that requires humility. And that's not one of my strongest character perspectives that I carry around. So on 52, this is one of the only descriptions of the spiritual malady, right? So it says, doctor's opinion, restless, irritable, discontented, right? And then they say on page 52, we had to ask ourselves why we shouldn't apply our human problems to the same readiness to change our point of view. We were having, or I do this, I go, am I having trouble with personal relationships? Can I control my emotional nature? Am I prey to misery and depression? Can I make a living I find satisfactory? Have I had a feeling of uselessness? Am I in fear? Am I unhappy? Could I be of real help to other people? And I failed that miserably. And any time I go through that paragraph and I go, all right, what am I not doing? What am I not doing in my program, right? Am I, you know, where am I at on all three sides of the triangle? How many meetings am I getting to? Where am I at with my disciplines? Who am I helping? And any time I'm experiencing this at a heavy level, there's always holes. There's always holes in my program because, like, you know, things start to get good, right? How are we doing on time? Ooh. All right. So I've never met a guy who was a vehement atheist. I've always had guys that I've worked with, myself included, that believed there was something out there. I've had a lot of people with a lot of anger toward the church and, you know, whatever. And I'm like, look, that's not even close to what this is about. This is about having a problem and being willing to seek something. The rest of the stuff will happen as the result of the seeking. So I remember when I got through these pieces here and I got to, Charlie handed me off to his wife, Katie. And she started reading 60 to 63 with me and putting my name in the sentences after the ABCs here. Being convinced we were at step three is that we decided to turn our will and our life, our thoughts and our actions, over to the care of God as we understood Him. Just what do we mean by that and just what do we do? And the next two pages are going to explain it, right? It tells me now there's a requirement that Steve must be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. How have I been doing with that so far? My best thinking got me in a seat of Alcoholics Anonymous with my life on fire. Trying, right? On that basis, Steve is almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though his motives are good, right? So Steve tries to live by self-propulsion. Steve is like an actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. I love how they write this because they basically say we're going to have to turn our will and our lives over to this power. And then they proceed to tell us what an unsurrendered life looks like. Has this been your experience? Do you show up like this on a day-to-day basis? I thought the third step was always the third step prayer. I never knew there were requirements and considerations that I needed because you got to understand, 4 through 9 is not for the faint of heart. It says if Steve's arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. The delusion and expectation in that, right? The scripts I'm writing. Everybody, including myself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor, Steve, may sometimes be quite virtuous. See, if me hitting you with the hammer isn't working, I'm going to be the nice guy because I got a motive. I need to get what I want or I don't want to lose what I have. Those are, seem to be my two motives in life. And I have stage characters that go off into the, like the father, the son, the employee, the sponsor. I have all belief systems, old ideas, and even programming, like from being a father or a son, or like fathers are, sons are, right? And fill in the blank, right? These are the belief systems that I walk around with that when you don't do what I say or want you to, I blow you up. See, well, didn't you get the memo? And I've made a decision based on self, which later places me into a position to be hurt, and I don't see it because I'm being driven by this under-the-surface stuff here that I don't even know is a problem. So now they're starting to set us up for the need for inventory. I got to understand what I'm turning over because this is going to be the stuff I'm going to be looking for in step 10, right? So what usually happens? The show doesn't come off very well. Steve begins to think life doesn't treat him right. Steve decides to exert himself more. Steve becomes, on the next occasion, still more demanding or gracious as the case may be. Still, the play does not suit him. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, he is sure that other people are more to blame. I am a great blame thrower. I don't know about you, but I can always blame you for my problems. Steve becomes angry, column 2, indignant, column 3, and self-pity in column 4. What is his basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker, even when trying to be kind? Right? I love the people pleasers. Those are the ones that scare me the most, because they're the ones, while they're smiling at you, are finding out and thinking about where to put your body. Right? I've heard a lot of inventory from those folks, and I'm telling you what, they got a lot of motives behind that smile. Steve is self-centered, egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. He's like the retired businessman who lives on the Florida sunshine in the winter, complaining of the sad state of the nation, because I lived in Florida for a period of time complaining. The minister who sighs over the sins of the 20th century, politicians and reformers who are sure all would be, if the rest of the world would only behave, everything would be utopia. And then it gets down here to 62 where it starts to take an about face. Remember what it says, just what do we mean by that and just what do we do? This is where they tell us what they mean. Selfishness and self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our problems, troubles, not vodka, not drugs. I'm like, what? You mean alcohol and drugs is basically a branch and a leaf that I keep trimming by trying to just not drink and go to meetings. And under the surface, the root system that feeds the tree is selfishness and self-centeredness. Wow, that blew my mind. Driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. A lot of self in that. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt me seemingly without provocation. Like, what's your problem? We invariably find that at some time in the past we've made decisions based on self which later placed us in a position to be hurt. So my troubles, I think, are basically of my own making. One of the greatest promises in this book. If my problems are coming from me and not at me, I can change me and I have a say in that. But if they're coming from you, you have to change in order for me to be okay. And I don't have that kind of power. Great statement of hope right there. Above everything, I have that circled. What do those two words mean to you? We alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without his aid. Down at the bottom of the page, it says, this is the how and why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Next, we decided that hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal. We are his agents. So this is the second requirement to step three, guys. They are literally outlining a deal that I'm going to make with this power, right? And it's all based on self, these manifestations of self that I'm being driven by. You ever get driven by an Uber guy? You have no control over what happens because you're not behind the wheel. You're a passenger, right? That's what self, that's what, well, how important this self piece is that I'll delve into next week in inventory. But it says, he is the father, we are his children. Most good ideas are simple, and this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. So this is the Greek aqueduct stone that holds the entire structure together. That's how important this thing. And everything from this decision on and this deal that we make is going to either point back to it or refer to it. Right? We're either, it's going to stem from it or refer back to it. Right? That's how important this thing, this self piece is. Guys, I missed this for 18 years. 18 years, and I'm sitting there going around thinking I'm doing the deal in Alcoholics Anonymous, and if I'd have died before I got into this book, I would have said, man, I tried AA. I never even touched it. I was in the fellowship. Right? So it says, when we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer, being all-powerful. Here it is. He provided what we needed if, conditional, we kept close to him and performed his work well. Mm-hmm. And there ain't nothing else. That's it. And anytime I'm struggling, that's another one my sponsor points out. And he goes, let's go back to 63 and read it again. And I'm like, good. God's going to provide what I need, or whatever you want to call it, higher power, God, spiritual giant, whatever. He provided what I need if I keep close to him and perform his work well. And I can't keep close to him unless I get close to him. I can't get close to him if I'm blocked. So that's why they set the stage for the resentment inventory, right? The fear inventory, our sex conduct inventory, because that's how these manifestations show up in self. And they're the three biggest ones that I'm going to pick up a drink over. Which is why we do these three, right? So it says, it gives us a bunch of step three promises, right? Less and less established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. We were reborn. Who doesn't want these things to happen in their lives? I mean, think about that. But I don't like to do the evening review. I don't like to pray and meditate. And this is what I suffered behind for the longest period of time. I started to kind of pick and choose what I wanted to do to recover. And they don't say this is an option, right? It's like a cake recipe. You put all these ingredients in, you get a cake. You start taking things out, you ain't getting a cake. You ain't getting something else, right? It's not probably going to taste very good. All right, so with that, I'm going to shut up because I've kind of gone over a little bit, but I'm going to open up to you guys. Thanks for having me.